Hello, I'm John Dennis. It's Friday, October the 31st. Today we assess the fallout for the BBC over Manuelgate.
It was ugly, it was revolting, and it was infantile, but it wasn't the end of the world.
Also in today's programme, John McCain's last stand in a town called Defiance, Ohio.
Although he keeps telling people at these rallies that he's going to fight on and that he's no quitter, really time seems to be running out.
The government advises expectant mothers not to drink alcohol at all during pregnancy, but a new study suggests that the odd glass of wine might be good for the unborn child.
Mothers who fell into the light drinking category were far more socially advantaged compared to abstinent mothers and indeed compared to mothers who fell into the heavy or binge drinking category.
Guardian Daily with John Dennis on guardian.co.uk.
But first, here's Sandy Waugh with the news headlines for today and the papers.
The controller of BBC Radio 2, Leslie Douglas, has resigned and Jonathan Ross has been suspended for 12 weeks following the row over obscene phone calls made on Russell Brand's show. Ross, who hosts a Friday night chat show and film 2008 on BBC One, as well as a Saturday morning slot on Radio 2, will not be paid during his suspension. Russell Brand's already resigned from his show on Radio 2. The Director General, Mark Thompson, hopes the matter will now draw to a close, but some insiders are questioning his role in the organisation following a series of high-profile scandals. Ban Ki-moon, the UN Secretary-General, is warning of a crisis of catastrophic proportions in eastern Congo after a surge in fighting between the government and rebel forces. A ceasefire is in place in the city of Goma, where tens of thousands of people have fled as rebels advanced. Rebel leader Laurent Nkunda, who commands about 10,000 men, has said he wants to take Goma near the border with Rwanda, but has so far heeded UN demands to stay out of the city. Jackie Smith, the Home Secretary, has asked the Attorney General to investigate possible criminal wrongdoing by the MI5 and the CIA over its treatment of a British resident held in Guantanamo Bay. The case centres around a High Court judgment which found that an MI5 officer participated in the unlawful interrogation of Binyam Mohamed. Charges against Mohamed, including that he was involved in a dirty bomb plot, have been dropped, allegedly to prevent the US from revealing torture evidence. The US authorities now plan to charge him with other offences. Today's the new deadline for filing paper tax returns. The government brought forward the deadline from the end of January as part of a major revamp of the system. Late filers face an automatic £100 penalty, although forms picked up from Revenue Office letterboxes first thing on Tuesday will avoid fines. The deadline for filing online tax returns remains January the 31st. In sport, British racing driver Lewis Hamilton is insisting he has learned from his experience last year and will go into Sunday's Brazilian Grand Prix with no intention of letting the World Championship slip from his grasp. Hamilton needs to finish in the top five to claim the title, and you can follow it live from 5pm on Sunday at guardian.co.uk/sport. Now for a look at today's papers, and it's the mayhem at the BBC which continues to dominate the front pages. The BBC wakes up to decency, says the Daily Mail, which says the suspension will cost Jonathan Ross £16,000 per day. Inside the paper, furious columnist Richard Littlejohn says, "We're mad as hell and we don't have to take it anymore." The Sun, meanwhile, says that Radio 2's Leslie Douglas should not have resigned over the matter and will be a great loss to the BBC. Winter's here already, says the Daily Express, which features snowy pictures from Scotland and the West Midlands. In the Telegraph, a new opinion poll shows Labour are gaining ground on the Conservatives. The Tories now have only a 9-point lead, down from 24 points in May. And the FT reports that a 0.3% fall in GDP in the US means an American recession is looming. On the back pages, the Telegraph reports that Lewis Hamilton's been the subject of racist abuse on a Spanish website. Meanwhile, in the Sun, Arsenal manager Arsene Wenger is said to be ready to wield the axe following a dressing room bust up after the midweek draw against rival Spurs. More news and sport throughout the day at guardian.co.uk.
There's continued hand-wringing at the BBC over the prank phone call from Jonathan Ross and Russell Brand to the actor Andrew Sachs. Yesterday, Mark Thompson, the Director-General of the BBC, briefed the BBC Trust, chaired by Sir Michael Lyons, about the crisis. Jenny Russell is a former editor of The World Tonight on BBC Radio 4. She gave her reaction to Nick Watt, presenter of our Politics Weekly podcast.
what the stars did was absolutely repulsive. And one of the things that I particularly object to it is that the idea that you have had sex with a woman is then a matter of shame for her and triumph for you. I think that is an undercurrent here which is incredibly unpleasant and which hasn't really been addressed. And I think it's absolutely right that people protested about it. Where I think it's got hysterical is that I see no need for anybody to lose their jobs. I mean, these are comedians. This wasn't funny, but it's the job of the BBC to draw the line and say, don't behave like this. And I think the real issue here wasn't what they did, which everybody should have their wrists slapped for, but the BBC's procedures. I don't see that members of BBC staff who agreed that it should go through should be sacked either. I mean, people make mistakes. Just say, don't do it again. Here's a line. This is where we think it should be drawn.
Why is it that the BBC management were so slow and then their response will be, as you're saying, pretty pathetic? Is it because Mark Thompson was in Sicily, so he wasn't providing direction? Or is it that it's basically a flabby public sector organisation swishing around in loads of cash and it's overpaid people, overpromoted? I mean, what's the... You've been there. What's the problem?
The tendency when there are crises is that people at the top all ring each other frantically, and then once 20 of them have all exchanged gossip about who said what in the corridors, then nobody actually feels the need to make a decision, and they hide behind the fact that there are so many of them. And they don't want to get out there in public and take individual responsibility. They prefer to be shielded by the fact that all of them together have decided something is dreadful. But everyone wants to hide. I'm afraid it is flabby at the top, and I'm afraid Thompson only returned now because he was ordered to do so, apparently, by Sir Michael Lyons, not even because he felt it was time for him to take responsibility. It's shameful.
Jenny Russell with Nick Watt and Julian Glover on our Politics Weekly show. Well, sharing her views on Manuelgate over on our Media Talk podcast is Liz Forgan, former managing director of BBC Radio and the chair of the Scott Trust Limited, which owns The Guardian.
I think looking at it, what went wrong is not that the processes were not in place. The BBC is full of processes. What went wrong is a matter of human judgment. Somebody looked at that programme and thought it was the right thing to transmit on the BBC.
So that's not something that you can legislate against with producer guidelines then, isn't it? So all these people who are clamouring for the rules to be tightened up, that's not the issue to address.
Well, every time something like this happens, there's a clamour for the rules to be tightened up and a great song and dance has gone through and someone declares that the rules have indeed been tightened up and many more rules are written and it doesn't actually make any difference. The problem is twofold. One is the power of really hot entertainment stars. And that has changed as the years have gone on and as the proliferation of channels has hotted up the competition for those talents. The ability to control them is getting harder and harder.
The problem is, I guess, is if you pay talent so much money, the more you pay them, the more difficult it gets to control them, paradoxically.
That's, of course, right. And, you know, telling somebody of the power and profile of Jonathan Ross or Russell Brand that you're not going to transmit what they're saying is a very hard thing to ask a young person who's probably earning a 20th of what they're earning to do. It's not an easy matter. But that's why the BBC has elaborate systems for referring upwards and upwards and upwards and upwards. And, you know, you can't get away from the fact here that somebody, apparently, at a relatively senior level, thought this was right to transmit on the BBC. And the BBC's attitude now is not to argue about that. It's to admit that it was not right. So why is it that a considered judgment by a relatively senior editorial figure, we hear, made that wrong judgment call? And I'm afraid that it's about a change in the way the BBC employs its staff. Once upon a time, people worked for the BBC, person and boy, for years and years and years, and they kind of breathed in the ethos with every day of their lives. Now people are there on contracts of 3-6 months. They come and go. It's a wholly different setup. And I don't think that there are in place proper ways of transmitting that instinct for what an audience will put up with or be frightened and shocked by. Talented entertainers are constantly offending the audience, and so they should. That's part of the nature of inventiveness and creativity. But it's the job of executives at the BBC, who are not underpaid, to understand when they've gone across a line. You know, they got it wrong this time. But why did it take so long for the organisation at any serious level to recognise that, I think that's a good question.
Liz Forgan, and there's more from her and the rest of the team in this week's Media Talk podcast. You can listen to that and Politics Weekly at guardian.co.uk/audio, and you can follow the latest on the whole sorry saga at mediaguardian.co.uk. Also on The Guardian's website today, we look at George Bush's cultural legacy at guardian.co.uk/arts. 1 year after The Guardian launched Katine, its Ugandan development project, find out what's been achieved and tell us what you think at guardian.co.uk/Katine. That's K-A-T-I-N-E. And Peter Washington's top 10 stories for Halloween, find out what they are, guardian.co.uk/books. In the last days of the US election campaign, most voters have made up their minds about John McCain and Barack Obama. Both candidates are now urging their supporters to get out and vote. Suzanne Goldenberg reports from the town of Defiance in Ohio, where McCain was rallying Republicans yesterday.
Defiance is a town in northwestern Ohio, and it takes its unusual name from a fort that was built here in 1794 by a man known as Mad General Wayne. And he said that this fort could defend this outpost from Indians, from the English, and from all the devils of hell. So it was perhaps appropriate that John McCain came here to launch his bus tour of Ohio, visiting the small towns of Heartland America. He hopes will be able to help him catch up with Barack Obama and win the White House.
Get your buttons right here, Joe the Plumber button.
It's great to be back in Ohio. We need to win Ohio.
Lord, I think you'll all agree with me that we all...
Across the country in Florida, Barack Obama began his day today campaigning on similar themes. He's hitting hard on the issue of the economy, saying he's going to help uplift the middle classes. He's casting McCain simply as a continuation of the last 8 years of George Bush.
From George Bush when it comes to the economy.
While both men here who are competing for the White House, John McCain and Barack Obama, are talking about similar themes, that is, the economy, they're doing it in a very different order of magnitude. Here in Ohio, John McCain is getting around by bus. Barack Obama is jetting around by plane. He's also blanketed the airwaves. This is the week that saw Obama carry out an unprecedented domination of primetime television. He had a half-hour infomercial go out on TV.
With each passing month, our country's faced increasingly difficult times. But everywhere I go...
He's also had this extraordinary high-powered rally with Bill Clinton in Florida.
And I want to talk to you a little about why it is so important to make sure that Florida is in the Obama column next Tuesday night.
John McCain, meanwhile, is operating on a smaller scale. He's got less money, and it shows in these battleground states where he has campaigned this week, from Pennsylvania to Ohio to Florida. His ads are not that visible on television screens. And while he has had a few events in big stadiums, for the most part, his rallies have been much more small scale.
Thank you for being here today at Everglades Lumber, a symbol of small business.
In all of the events that we've seen this week, John McCain is making essentially the same appeal to Republican and independent voters. Don't believe the polls. It's not over yet. We can still catch up. We can still win the White House.
The pundits have written us off, just like they've done several times before.
Now, that message is wearing a little thin. John McCain's own party, his fellow Republicans, have come out and attacked him. They have criticized him for choosing Sarah Palin. They say he doesn't adequately represent the party. At the grassroots level, you still hear people telling you, look, I don't think the polls are telling us the truth. I think we can do it.
I think it's extremely close. I was talking to my husband yesterday. I think that it could be thrown into the House of Representatives, you know. It could be that close.
What do you mean? It could be a tie?
Yes. Either one could possibly not get a majority.
Now there's only 5 days to go for John McCain to try and catch up with Obama. Just 5 days for McCain to pull it out. And although he keeps telling people at these rallies that he's going to fight on and that he's no quitter, really time seems to be running out.
Suzanne Goldenberg. I'm John Dennis. Still to come on Guardian Daily, Zan Brooks gives his verdict on the new James Bond film, Quantum of Solace.
It's a film with hardly any plot. It's a film with hardly any dialogue. It's a film, weirdly, where even the sex is on a kind of subsistence ration. Bond doesn't bed nearly as many women as we're accustomed to seeing.
But first, contrary to official advice, light drinking by mothers during pregnancy does not cause mental or behavioural problems for their children. In fact, it might even help them, according to a new study. Researchers at University College London examined the behaviour and mental skills of 12,500 three-year-olds and looked at their mothers' drinking patterns during pregnancy. The study's lead author is Dr. Yvonne Kelly of UCL's Epidemiology and Public Health Department.
Our results suggest that there is no increased risk of behavioural or cognitive difficulties for children who were born to mothers who drank light levels of alcohol during pregnancy compared to mothers who abstained from alcohol during pregnancy.
What do we mean by light levels of alcohol consumption?
That would be not more than one or two units per week.
And obviously the government, the Department of Health, recommends complete abstinence during pregnancy. Is that the right approach in the light of your research?
Our research suggests that there isn't any increased risk for women drinking light levels of alcohol during pregnancy. The NICE guidelines advise that women should avoid alcohol in the first trimester, and thereafter, if they choose to drink alcohol, then not to exceed one or two units once or twice per week.
How does heavy drinking during pregnancy affect children?
It's been well established that heavy drinking during pregnancy is linked to a set of conditions called fetal alcohol syndrome. And this is related to some physical differences in children affected by this particular syndrome, as well as long-term social and learning difficulties throughout life.
How much research has been done into the effects of light drinking in pregnancy?
Very little. And the Royal College of Obstetricians and Gynaecologists and the National Perinatal Epidemiology Unit called for studies, particularly in this area, in populations of children, looking at the associations between light levels of alcohol consumption during pregnancy and consequent behavioural and cognitive outcomes in those children.
Might light drinkers tend to be more socially advantaged than abstainers or people who drink heavily?
They are, yes. And our study shows that finding very clearly. Mothers who fell into the light drinking category were far more socially advantaged compared to abstinent mothers, and indeed compared to mothers who fell into the heavy or binge drinking category.
And I suppose people who drink very small amounts of alcohol during a week might tend to be more relaxed.
Well, possibly.
Dr. Yvonne Kelly of UCL. The Westfield Shopping Centre in West London's White City has more than 1.6 million square feet of space. It's home to 265 retail units, and it took 5 years to build at a cost of £1.6 billion. Westfield was launched yesterday amid fanfare, courtesy of the singer Leona Lewis and the London Mayor Boris Johnson.
I think there are plenty of people sitting on piles of money out there who could come and invest in some of the wonderful shops here in Westfield. And I don't want to. I think of huge sums of taxpayers' money currently reposing in the bank accounts of certain BBC presenters I could name, ladies and gentlemen. Huge sums. And I don't want to jump on the bandwagon, a bandwagon whose axle is already groaning with politicians upon it. But I suggest, how about this as an idea? Why don't those BBC presenters atone for their mistakes? Disgorge those millions of taxpayers' gold and come and spend it here in Westfield on Christmas presents for the poor and needy children of London. How about that, ladies and gentlemen? Isn't that an idea?
Westfield is not as big as Gateshead's Metro Centre or Bluewater in Kent, but it is the biggest inner-city shopping mall in Europe. And it opens for business just as the credit crunch pushes the UK into a recession. Guardian Daily's Scott Corley gauged the reaction of shoppers.
It's massive, isn't it? It's huge. Some good shops, though. Good shopping under my belt, so that's good.
So you get a nice sort of balance, really. You know, you get your M&S, your usual sort of high street shops, and the other shops are just...
Like Chanel, isn't there, and Gucci, and all those sort of upper class, you know, high class shops.
It's nice. It's big.
Quite cool and modern. Yeah.
And we think we just saw Leona Lewis, but we're not sure.
It was a lookalike.
I don't like it that much because it's a bit spaced out. And also they don't have any free stuff. We expected free
stuff. We wanted free stuff. We came specially.
There's not as many people here as I thought there would be. It's half term. The kids are off school. And I thought it would be buzzing. I thought there would be a lot more people.
Hi, I'm Anita. I'm the head of HR for Rugby and Pella. I think you'll get a good mix of people. The fact that you've got high street luxury and, you know, semi-luxury and great luxury all under one roof, which means they don't have to go from Oxford Circus to Knightsbridge and then hop back again. I think you'll find a lot of people coming here shopping on a regular basis.
I'm Nikki and I am the training manager for Rigby and Pella. First of all, people just come because it's amazing and it's getting a lot of press, but then obviously it'll then possibly minorly dip and then probably pick up again for Christmas. So it probably won't be till about the sort of middle of next year that they really find out how it's going to be, but I think they'll be fine here. I mean, ultimately, this is London, which always performs slightly better than the rest of the country anyway.
We couldn't speak with anticipation this morning. It's just something new on our doorstep. We wanted to go to big shops, Oxford Street, forget about it now. You just come here.
I feel as though I'm in a different place. This doesn't come in like Shepherd's Bush.
What do you think the prospects are for the shopping centre in, well, there's a kind of a credit crunch going on?
That's what I just asked my friend, how we'll see it in 1 year's time. We will see if it works or not.
What do you think?
It will, because it's lovely. It's inside, you don't care about the weather. It's nice, you can stay all day long here.
I think it's amazing.
Definitely got the wow factor.
Free stuff.
Oh my God, free stuff.
Oh,
where did you get free stuff from?
Guardian Daily. News and reports from around the world.
How long have I got? 30 seconds. That doesn't give us a lot of time.
Quantum of Solace opens today in UK cinemas. It's Daniel Craig's second appearance as 007, and it picks up where Casino Royale left off. It's the 22nd James Bond film in the series. Our film critic, Zan Brooks, says the franchise is in rude health.
I was always very interested to meet you. I'd heard so much about you from Vesper. If she hadn't killed herself, we would have had you too.
Are you going to tell us who you work for?
The first thing you should know about us is that we have people everywhere.
How does it rank? I mean, because Casino Royale, Daniel Craig's first Bond film, was held as being really one of the best Bond films and Craig one of the best Bonds. Does he keep up that level of quality in this film?
Yes, he does. And Quantum of Solace, I think, is a sort of sequel of sorts to Casino Royale, which I think is kind of unprecedented in the Bond series. That doesn't mean to say that if you haven't seen Casino Royale, you won't know what's going on, because you kind of don't really know what's going on anyway. It's endless stunts. There are kind of chases with every single vehicle known to man. There's a plane chase, there's a boat chase, there's a car chase. And it's just a kind of a non-stop sort of adrenaline ride, really, this film. And Craig is superb in it again. I mean, I think, you know, there was the sort of the thrill of the new when he was in Casino Royale. So he had a lot of kind of goodwill towards him because of that. And he's kind of backed it up with this film.
I thought I could trust you. You said you weren't motivated by revenge.
I'm motivated by my duty.
I think you're so blinded by inconsolable rage that you don't care who you hurt. When you can't tell your friends from your enemies, it's time to go.
You don't have to worry about me.
This film's been criticised for lacking a sense of humour. Would you go along with that?
Yeah, absolutely. There are no jokes in it at all. None that I could see, really. It's definitely... the director, Mark Forster, has referenced the John Borman film Point Blank as an influence for this film, which is one of the kind of nastiest, meanest sort of thrillers around. Another reference point that he's probably playing a bit coy about are the Bourne films. There's a definite kind of Bourne sensibility to this in terms of the character just basically being a trained killer who is just kind of knocking off people the whole time, and even to the extent that you know, where Roger Moore never had a kind of hair out of place and maybe, you know, never any lint on his tuxedo even, you know, Daniel Craig spends most of this film with kind of blood splats on his face and his hair all mussed up, and looking, you know, slightly the worse for wear.
We need you to get rid of him.
When you can't tell your friends from your enemies, it's time to go.
Right now, I think you're the only person I can trust.
James, move your ass.
I wish I could set you free, but your prison is in there.
So, not much sex, not much plot, not much dialogue. Gadgets?
Not much gadgets. Really, you know, what's this film got going for it if it doesn't have all those kind of Bond elements? And I guess what it has going for it is a confidence and a speed and a pace and a punch. And it does the job. It's apparently the shortest Bond film ever made. So presumably a lot of that was kind of dropped on the cutting room floor. And you've basically just got a man in crisis being chased and occasionally chasing.
Zand Brooks. And in this week's Film Weekly podcast, the director of Quantum of Solace, Mark Forster, is interviewed by Jason Solomons as part of his In the Director's Chair series of videos. Today's Guardian Daily was produced by Andy Duckworth and Phil Maynard. My name's John Dennis. Thank you for listening.